The subject that was chosen was the subject of cruelty to animals, all creatures great and small. And the whole idea, I suppose, of animals in the Jewish outlook on life. Now, what's the first blessing? There's a whole list of morning blessings that we say every day. And the first of those blessings is a very, very bizarre blessing. Anyone know what it is? There's a whole section of morning blessings. That's right. We say, blessed are you, our God, King of the universe, who has given the rooster intelligence to distinguish between day and night. Now, if you've ever been on a farm, I was on a kibbutz about a month ago for a Shabbat, and the roosters, bless them, started crowing at about 5 in the morning. I didn't wake up and say, thank God for the roosters. I woke up looking for my axe. You know, what does it mean? Why do we make a blessing that thank God for the rooster crowing? Isn't that a strange type of blessing? So, of course, some translate sechvi as human intelligence, the ability of humans to distinguish. But the standard translation of sechvi is indeed rooster, and we appear to be making a blessing for the rooster's ability to distinguish between day and night. So Rav Kook explains in his commentary on the prayer book the following idea. He says, the rooster crowing is a manifestation of a connection between the human being and the natural world. Why does the rooster crow? We don't know what pressures of natural selection caused the rooster to crow, what genetic mutation gave it that ability, what survival advantage is there in the rooster crowing in the morning. We have no idea. But from a theistic point of view, from the point of view of a believer in God, we can ask ourselves what the purpose of something is, because we believe things have a purpose. Does the rooster crow to wake up other roosters? Unlikely, because they're all crowing. Does it crow to wake up itself? No, it can't crow unless it's awake. So it must already wake up in order to crow. So why is it crowing? We don't know. We would say, Rav Kook says, that one of the reasons it's crowing is to arouse us from our slumber to start our day's work. Get up and serve Hashem today. In a sense, Rav Kook says, the rooster crowing is a manifestation of a connection between the human being and the natural world. It just happens to be the very first manifestation of the connection between us and the natural world and the animals is when I'm woken up by the rooster crowing. So he says, really, it's appropriate to make a blessing on that. Thank God, we would say, that the rooster crows and wakes me up. It's an interconnection between myself and the natural world. Because you see, we look at the world as divided into two sections. The primary creations and the secondary creations. That is to say, a primary creation, a primary creature, is a creature that exists for its own sake. That is to say, it in and of itself, through itself, can achieve some level of perfection, spirituality and greatness that would justify its existence. And then you have secondary creatures. Why are the secondary creatures here? They are here for the sake of the primary creatures. They don't have an independent justification for existence. They are secondary in the sense they are here as a support system for the rest, for the primary. We look at animals, at flora and fauna, at the entire natural world as a necessary support system for the human being, but ultimately for the sake of the human being. Marine biologists have recently discovered some disturbing facts about dolphins. Dolphins, we all used to watch Flipper when we were kids. Right? What could be more cute than a dolphin's smile, right? And dolphins playing, you know, in the water, in the wake of a ship? Right? Well, these dolphins, they're so cute, they torture harbor seals to death. They bite their own children. They've found bodies of baby dolphins, buttered and bitten by their parents. Dolphins, one of the few creatures of the sea to commit rape, and few creatures in the world. And dolphins, actually quite vicious. Quite vicious. Leopard seals. Cute, furry leopard seals. White fur, brown eyes, black nose. Very cute. When they're 9 months old, according to Natural History magazine, what they do is, they're very cute, they drag penguins off the ice pack, break their legs, half drown them in the water for 40 minutes while they're pulling pieces off their flesh and then leave them to die. Aren't they cute? Right, so you see, we look at dolphins and penguins and we look at, you know, these animals and we say, oh, it's got a nice smile, and then we get eaten. Right. In other words, why don't we punish dolphins for these acts of cruelty? Why don't dolphins deserve punishment for these acts of cruelty? I mean, if a human would do the type of thing dolphins do, we'd certainly punish a human. Why don't we punish a dolphin for that? The reason is very simple. Dolphins don't have free will. Right? Free Willy doesn't have free will. Right? They don't have the ability to make moral decisions here. Right? They don't have the ability to say, this is wrong, I should not do it, or this is appropriate and I should do it. They are hardwired. They operate on instinct. They do not operate on moral free will, and hence it's inappropriate to punish them. They're just following their conditioning, whatever the conditioning may be. You can mess up their conditioning, you can change their conditioning, but it's conditioning. And consequently, a dolphin, therefore, however intelligent it may be, however communicative it may be, is not a primary aspect of creation. It is a secondary aspect of creation. It's part of the support system for the primary creature, who is the human being. And that's why someone once told me that, and this is a common claim. I have heard this said of a person who says, I don't eat other animals. Don't eat other animals. Now, we would say, the truth is, neither do we. We don't eat other animals. We're not other animals. We are intrinsically different and distinguished from the animals. And if we are not intrinsically different from the animals, then there is nothing wrong with eating other animals. Would anyone say that it's wrong for the lion to eat a wildebeest or a dik-dik? Do you know what a dik-dik and a wildebeest are? No. Okay, they are deer-type creatures that live in Africa, okay, which are regular lion fodder, right? Lions love these. They're delicious, right? Lion candy. Oh, a nice little dik-dik just for a snack, right? Beautiful deer-like creature. The lion grabs it, breaks its neck with one shot, right, mauls it, eats it. That's it. Would anyone say it's wrong for the lion to eat another animal? Is it immoral? Of course not. If you are another animal, there's nothing wrong with eating it. There's nothing wrong. And if we are not other animals, that is because we are intrinsically different, superior from those animals. We have free will, we have moral consciousness, we have a soul. And consequently, that is how the human being, that's how we view the world. And when we say that blessing in the morning, that you give the rooster wisdom, we are blessing God for the fact that he created this entire system in order to have a human being. Some would extend it even further. Some would say it goes even to the extent of the stars. The correct amount of carbon in the universe, the physical constants of the universe, the constants of the gravitational force, electrical force, electromagnetic force are fine-tuned for the existence of life. And the laws of biology and physics and chemistry are fine-tuned to produce intelligent life. And all this is for the sake of the human. So therefore, we have to ask ourselves, why should God create a system where there are animals at all? It's conceivable that there would just be humans and flora, just vegetables and humans. Why have something like almost intermediate between human and vegetable? Why is it so? So without getting into the mystical aspect, which would say that there's always a gradation of things from, just as there is from God, the infinite, to the finite world, there's a steady gradation down. So also, from the human being to the lowest levels of creation, there's a gradation, there's a continuum. But I think there's another aspect. If you look at source number one, it's a Babylonian Talmud, tells us that Judah the prince, Rabbi Yonah HaNasi, the author of the Mishnah, he had terrible, terrible stomach pains. He had a terrible stomach disease. And it says his suffering came about as a result of an incident in which a calf, on its way to being slaughtered, broke away from the line and came to Rabbi Yehuda and snuggled against him. It put its head under the edge of his garment and cried. And Rabbi Yehuda said, Judah the prince said, go! You were created for this! And he pushed it back to the line. Now, from a philosophical point of view, is he correct? Philosophically, is 100% correct? That is what it was created for. What is the calf going to do? Is the calf going to invent a cure for cancer? Is the calf going to create a philosophical way of looking at the world that will raise the ethical sensibility of people? Is the calf going to become a righteous calf? You ever heard of a cow saying, I'll kick the alfalfa habit? No. the calf. That's what it was created for. But nevertheless, we are told that it appears that he was wrong in doing this. Was wrong. And he started to, and he got suffered. He suffered as a result of that. So his suffering ended as a result of another incident in which his maid was cleaning the house. There were some baby weasels there. She was about to get the broom and whack them. And Rabbi Yehuda Anasi said, leave them. The Rachamav al Kol Ma'asav Ktiv. His mercy is upon all his creatures, it says in Psalms. And as soon as he said that, his disease ended. Amazing. So Judah the prince suffers as a result of apparent cruelty to an animal, and his suffering ends when he shows mercy towards the animal. But from a philosophical, from an intellectual perspective, he was correct in what he said to the animal. He was correct in pushing it away. If so, why did he suffer as a result? So there are two answers. I think the answer is, one answer really, which has one ramification. The answer is the following. That the human cannot act based purely on the intellect. The human has to also, individual has to have sensitivity and has to be aware of emotional aspects of life as well. So from an intellectual point of view, you'd say to the calf, that's what you were created for, but it's snuggling against you. It's crying, it's got its head under your garment, right? And you are just going to go. Right? So that was insensitivity, and because of that he suffered. When later on, his maid was about to drive the weasels away from their house, which is also permitted, according to Jewish law, right? Which is nothing wrong with it. He's prevented her from doing so. He said, they're baby weasels, leave them. God's mercy is upon all his creatures. That's when his suffering ended. What we see from here is that the way we treat animals is not just a matter of what's intellectually and philosophically appropriate, but there's also a matter of creating a certain emotional sensitivity within the human being that's also something which is very, very important. And I heard from a Rabbi Malevsky, Olav Shalom, who said the following. He said, one of the things that we can perhaps deduce from this Gemara is perhaps a general idea about what the whole purpose of having animals at all is for. He says, these are our tests. These are a test of human sensitivity to those who are subordinate. The human is meant to be godlike. We're meant to become closer to God, compatible, similar to God, as we mentioned in previous classes. So God has subordinates. God has creatures beneath him, the human being also. There are living, breathing creatures which are subordinate to us. One of the tests of the human being in life is, what's the sensitivity of the human being? How do we act towards these subordinate creatures? So there are subordinate creatures which we are allowed to use, which are there for us, but on the other hand, we cannot cross the line between use on the one hand and abuse on the other hand. And that's why Jewish law has a balance, halacha, which means, what does halacha mean? Halacha means Jewish law. What is the root of halacha? Halach, which means? No. To walk. So Jewish law means the way of walking. What does that mean? You cannot walk unless you have balance. I have a friend in Toronto who recently had an inner ear infection. He was in bed for 3 weeks. He was incapable of even the slightest movement because he'd be just thrown totally out of balance. Right? You cannot walk without balance. You have to balance. Okay, so halacha also provides us with a balance in life. There's an extreme in which the person says, other animals. There was a protest in Tel Aviv once in which the animal rights were protesting about the killing of dogs by the government, local council, killing stray dogs. And the signs they had up were, Kulanu Kilavim, which means, we're all dogs. Now, I thought to myself, that's a tragedy. We are not all dogs. Right? We're not dogs. We're humans. We're intrinsically different. We're intrinsically superior. And they are here for us. On the other hand, their sentiment and their emotion was certainly appropriate. Right? The fact that they had a sensitivity to the way these dogs were being killed, the fact that they had a sensitivity to the suffering of a subordinate creature, is certainly a positive thing. It is certainly good. On the other hand, their extreme in the other direction was not good. We're all dogs is not a concept that we would agree with. A good friend of mine, Suki Berry, had a couple over at his house from the Western Wall. They came to his house for Shabbat. And he was giving around the bread on Shabbat meal. And the man said, oh, excuse me, but no salt on my bread. He said, fine. So he gave him bread without salt. He figured, guy's on a low-sodium diet. And the guy says, do you want to know why I don't want salt? And my friend says, I don't care. Yeah. No big deal. You know, you have to have salt. It doesn't matter. Not a big deal. The guy says, no, I'd like to tell you why. All right, so tell me. He says, because I think it's barbaric. So my friend says, Suki says, barbaric to have salt? And he says, that's right, he says. Why do you have salt on your bread? Because of the sacrifices. He says, the sacrifices are barbaric. So first of all, Suki said, look, he was tempted to say, I don't know how barbaric the sacrifices were, but I would say, if you're a guest at someone's house who doesn't know you and who's invited you for a meal for free, and you call them barbarians, that's a little bit barbaric to me. But he didn't say that, because he's too nice. I would have said that. But anyway. But he said, well, why is it barbaric? He says, well, they're animals, killing animals. There's no difference. Who are we? We're just animals. So Suki said, you actually believe that you're basically an animal. He says, that's right, I'm just more intelligent. So his, remember, his fiancée was sitting next to him here. So Suki said, well, are you two planning on getting married? He says, yeah. He says, let me ask you something. Supposing you have a child. Nate, let's say, of course, we plan on having a child. It's wonderful, wonderful. And he says, and supposing he's training to be a vet, veterinary surgeon. And anyway, he's working in primate research. And he comes home one day and he says, Mum, Dad, I think I've found the person, I found the object of my love. I think I've decided on my partner in life. And they say, that's wonderful, wonderful. What's her name? He says, Coco. And they say, oh yes, that's a strange name. What? Where is she from? Kenya. And they're saying, well, and they say, what does she do? He says, she's in primate research. Works in a lab. Says, oh, fascinating. Yes, she's the primate. Now, would you have any objections, he said. So the guy said, well, he says, oh, don't give me well, right? Well, socially, not socially. Intrinsically speaking, would you have any objections to your son saying, Coco and I, right, the mountain gorilla, right, we're getting married. No, she's had all her shots, no problem, right? She's well trained. She's very good at the sign language. She can probably communicate better than most New Yorkers. Whatever. So, you know, so what's going on here? So he said, well, you're right. I wouldn't have any objection. So his fiance, in the meantime, is looking at him like, oh. Because obviously, deep down, we don't believe that. Deep down, we recognize that there is a difference. Deep down, we recognize that as wonderful as an animal can be, as emotional they can be and as intelligent they can be, they are animals. True, I had a dog for 13 years, Cocker Spaniel Labrador Cross. And he had within him spirituality. I know this because once I was leaning over the back balcony of my house in Australia and my yarmulke fell off. The dog and I both looked down, right? And we both make a mad dash down the stairs to get the yarmulke, right? And, you know, and he was much faster than me. He gets to the yarmulke first, and he's so excited by grabbing it first, he swallowed it whole. To those who say animals don't have any spirituality, think of my dog. So now, but as I said, so one extreme is we're all animals. We're all dogs, as the sign said in Tel Aviv. But the other extreme is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who did the wrong thing, who was totally insensitive. Totally insensitive. So what is halacha? Halacha is balance. Balance. Walking with a balance between two extremes. Miyamoto Musashi, the great Japanese swordsman who wrote the Book of the Five Rings. Anyone read it? I mean, if you're interested in swordsmanship in Japan, it's a very interesting book. Anyway, so forget it. Right, so Miyamoto Musashi points out that in fact he says the essence of all sword fighting and martial arts, he says, is always balance. He says, to move only with one foot, never do that. You always have to, any movement with a sword is always going to be both feet, because you have to be balanced. So halacha also says balance is what's required. So now let me give you an example. Number two in the outline. The Code of Jewish Law says, it is customary to say to someone who has bought new clothing, you say, tivaleh v'titchadesh. That's been shortened in modern Hebrew. We just say titchadesh. What does titchadesh mean? Someone buys a new pair of clothes, a new suit. What do you say? Titchadesh. Now, literally, what does titchadesh mean? Make it new? Well, what does it mean? It already is new. It's a new thing. Make it new. It's new. you turn it to Israeli dry cleaner, you will not make it new, guaranteed, right? So what they mean is, actually the expression is tivaleh v'titchadesh, which means you should live long enough to wear it out and get a new one. That's what it means. Tivaleh v'titchadesh is the ancient way of saying it. So someone gets a new suit, you don't say, nice suit, who shot the couch? Rather, what you say is, tivaleh v'titchadesh, wear it out and get a new one. That's wonderful, that's the blessing. But look at what the Shulchan Aruch says, Code of Jewish Law says. He says, there are those who wrote that one should not say this for shoes or clothing made of leather. For if he does wear it out, another animal will have to be killed to make the new garment. And it states his mercy is upon all his creations. Although this reasoning is not conclusive, many people do not say this blessing over leather clothing. And in fact, the custom is we don't say this blessing on leather clothing. Rather, right, in other words, what's the balance here? The balance is this. Are you allowed to wear leather clothing? Yes. That's one of the purposes of the existence of the animals, to provide that. However, should you exult and rejoice in it? So that, oh, wonderful, another animal dead. So, no. So on the one hand, what's our balance? We use it. Yes. Do we rejoice in it? No. So when someone gets a new, is that very similar? I was in Beverly Hills about 3 weeks ago for 4 weeks ago for Shabbos. And I saw in one of the stores, it was the Century City Mall, Beverly Hills Mall, and one of the stores there was advertising that the fur coat, there's a municipal law there apparently, if you buy a fur coat for more than a certain amount of money, inside it, in the label, it says a complete description of how the animal was killed. So, as you are putting on your fur coat, you know, it's got a picture of some Canadian with a six-pack of Molsons in one hand, right, and a Blue Jays baseball bat in the other hand, beating a seal to death, right? That's basically, right? So anyway, but again, right, although I think most people in Beverly Hills are just totally nuts, but there is a certain degree of truth to this. The certain degree of truth in it is that yes, like it says in the Code of Jewish Law, you can use the leather, but don't rejoice in it. In other words, be aware that an animal died. For instance, also, another extreme. I saw an interview when Ronald Reagan was elected president. What was his slogan, a kinder, gentler America? Who was that? Oh, that was George Bush, right? Senior. When George Bush was elected, right, his slogan was a kinder, gentler America. I don't know if his son, right, his son, since he was governor of Texas in 1995, they've had 119 executions. How kindly and gently America will be, you know, with George Bush is a good question. But anyway, the first George Bush, who said a kinder, gentler America, the first interview I saw with him in Newsweek magazine was done while he was hunting grouse on his estate. So here he is, he's saying, well, what we want is a kindler. There's a sucker, bam, right? Gentler, there's another one, bam, America. Now, the contradiction here is very clear. How can you engage in a sport which involves killing an animal, not for survival, it's not like he's a hunter who needs it to survive, a hunter-gatherer, right, dragging the mastodon back to the cave, right, that's not what he's doing, right, George Bush does not need to hunt grouse in Kennebunkport in order to survive, right, he doesn't need that. Rather, he's doing it for fun, isn't that fun? Right, chase an animal to the ground, right, fill it with adrenaline, which gives a taste to game, which is supposed to be good, right, and then shoot it, okay? Now, that's a contradiction. That's another extreme. So therefore, look at source number 3. Rabbi Cheskel Landau, the Noda Yehuda, was asked by a wealthy Jewish businessman in Prague who wanted to take some business partners, Gentiles, on a hunt on his estate. He had a large estate. He wanted to take them hunting, entertain his friends. Noda Yehuda says the following. I'm amazed by this activity. We have not found hunters in the Torah except for Nimrod and Esau. Two hunters mentioned in the Torah, both of them are nasty. Right, Nimrod was the person who tried to kill Abraham, threw him in the furnace. Esau was the evil son, right? Esau was the evil twin, right? He's the Macaulay Culkin of the Bible, right? And it says, this is not the way of sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. One should not say, wear it out and renew it to someone who has bought clothing made of animal skin, since it is written, his mercy is upon all his creatures. If so, how can an Israelite kill living beings without any other need than in order to pass his time by hunting? Therefore, this matter contributes to a negative trait, cruelty. It's forbidden and dangerous, and causes God to judge a person for his sins. How does he know that? Where does he derive that from? Cruelty to an animal will cause God to judge you strictly. Where does he know that from? Look at source number one. That's where he gets it from. Judah the prince. Okay? So, however, if someone requires it and his livelihood depends on hunting, he lives from this animal, the prohibition of cruelty is not applicable here. So in other words, again, there's the balance. The balance is, if it's necessary, he's allowed to do it. If it's not necessary, he's not, and he certainly should not rejoice in it. And if it's just for recreation, we cannot understand or conceive of someone spending their time in recreation by hunting and killing an animal. So now, I would say, therefore, that it's not really animal rights which Judaism emphasizes at all. Animals don't have rights. Rights are only possible for a thinking being with free will, with the idea of a moral imperative. Rather, instead of animal rights, what do we have? Human obligation. Humans are obligated to treat animals in a particular way. Humans are obligated to ensure that they don't become callous, that we don't become cruel, that we don't spend our time abusing animals. Rather, the human being is obligated to act in a way of justice and mercy and compassion. So it's not so much animal rights, it's human obligation. And that is really the essence of Jewish law, and that's why, for example, the Torah tells us, number four, there is a biblical obligation to prevent an animal from suffering. Where do we derive this from? There's a law called Perika Uti'ina, the obligation that if you see someone's donkey struggling under its burden, your obligation is to help him unload the donkey. And even if the person whose donkey you're unloading is an evil person, a corrupt individual, you're obligated to help him. Why? That's right, to help the donkey. And here we see it's not just a case of a prohibition for me to cause cruelty to animals, but really it's an obligation to prevent it. In other words, it's one step beyond. Right? It may be prohibited for me to be cruel to an animal, but here the Torah is telling me even one step before that. Not only am I prohibited from being cruel to an animal, but I'm obligated to take steps to alleviate its suffering, to remove the burden from the donkey. And here is the famous statement is made, Tsar Bale Chaim de Oraisa, the prohibition against cruelty to animals, or the obligation to alleviate their pain, is a biblical obligation. And this is something which we are obligated to teach our children. Yeah.
Isn't it also true that if you see your enemy trying to load his donkey, and there is a donkey, and your friend has a donkey who's crouching under his burden, and you have to help him unload it, you're supposed to help your enemy first?
That's correct. That's correct. The Gemara says, despite the fact that unloading the donkey is a greater mitzvah, because you're helping both the person and the donkey, nevertheless, you should help the person you don't like, your enemy, so to speak, before you help your friend. And the reason for that is the Gemara says that there's what we call kfiat yitzro. That is to say, the overcoming of your evil inclination. Because it's wrong to hate someone. So how do you overcome your evil inclination, which is that you hate this person? How do you do that? The answer is action. Do an action of kindness to this person by investing yourself in the other person. You will become identified with him and you will find it harder to hate him. So that would be an exception to the rule, right? And that's because of that specific idea, kfiat yetzer, the overcoming of the evil inclination. Now, we'll give you some other examples, number five, of derivation from the biblical text of this idea. Number five is the idea of shiluach hakein. The mitzvah, the Torah tells us that when you take eggs from a nest, you're obligated to shoo away the mother bird before taking the eggs. Why is it so? What is the rationale for that? Not that we can ultimately know why God would do it. I don't even know why other people do things. Right? I can't possibly second guess the infinite mind of God. But we can offer some ex post facto explanations for what the effect of a commandment is. What is the effect of the commandment of sending away the mother bird? What is the impact on us? Some commentaries say the idea here is that it says it's similar to the prohibition of he and his son do not slaughter on the same day. The reasoning of both commandments is to prevent one from becoming cruel of heart. They are both acts which are similar to the destruction of a species. What does that mean? It means the following. To destroy the mother and the child simultaneously, to slaughter the mother and the offspring on the same day, to take the mother and the eggs, is tantamount because you're destroying both the source and the offspring. So what are you doing? You're engaged. It's like a mini action of extinction of a species. It's almost as if you are causing its extinction. And that's an act of cruelty. In other words, again, the balance. Am I allowed to take the eggs and eat them? Yes. But I have to think about, but should I destroy the source as well? Let the mother go. Throw her away. Push her away. Then take the eggs. Don't destroy both. That, by the way, there are commentaries that say that that's the concept behind the biblical prohibition against eating meat and milk together. You see, meat and milk also represents the same idea. The source of the meat is an animal, right? What's milk? The source of life for the next generation of animals. Eating them both together is tantamount to taking the source and the fruit simultaneously. It's a little bit like extinction. And of course, and the Sefer HaChinuch and the Kolbo both say that the cause of the extinction of a species, aside from the cruelty in it, it's also an insane thing to do because you never know the impact. I'll just give you one example. In Mauritius, there was a bird called a dodo bird. Anyone heard of the dodo bird? Everyone seen a dodo bird? I doubt it, because they're extinct. Right? You've seen pictures. Now, when the dodo bird became extinct, what they found was that a couple of years later, a species of tree also became extinct. It died out. Why? Anyone know? Well, if it was food for the dodo, it would thrive after the dodo's extinct. But you're close, you're close. The dodo would eat its seeds. The only way the seeds of this tree could possibly germinate was by going through the digestive system of the dodo. And when the dodo became extinct, the seeds wouldn't germinate, the trees died out. Of course, those trees were also a habitat for various insects and reptiles, insects, which were eaten by various reptiles. The reptiles, of course, were eaten by mammals, certain mammals in the jungle, right? And those mammals may have been eaten by humans, right? Or when they die, they become fertilizer soil, they're eaten by fish. In other words, there's a whole chain of interconnection that we cannot even imagine in ecology, right, which we have to take into account. So therefore, the Torah gives us various commandments like, don't slaughter the mother and the offspring on the same day. Don't eat meat and milk together. Shoo away the mother bird when you take the egg. It's not banning outright the use, but it's saying use it wisely. Don't create the trait of cruelty into yourself. Use it responsibly. Number six, Nachmanides. The regulation of shchita, the slaughter of an animal, I understand it was talked a little bit about it yesterday, is in order to reduce the pain that the animal registers and acts as a reminder that we are not dealing with things outside the law. They are not automatons devoid of life, but they are living things. That is to say, shchita, which is the kosher method of slaughter, what is it? As I, you know, you probably were explained that it involves the cutting of the trachea and the esophagus, which will also generally cut the carotid and the jugular, the main arteries and veins to and from the brain, reducing the blood pressure of the animal to zero in a second or two, and hence the animal is rendered unconscious and then will die very quickly afterwards. The whole idea of shchita has many, many features which are designed to reduce the pain the animal feels. First of all, the knife has to be quite sharp, surgically sharp, and indeed it is checked for nicks on the side, each side of the blade and the top of the blade, on the shochets, the slaughterer's flesh, and on his fingernails. Right? Why does he check it that way? To simulate the flesh of the animal and to simulate the cartilage of the animal. If he feels a nick on it, he cannot slaughter it with that knife, because obviously if there's a nick tears, whereas a knife cuts by pressure. There are different methods of cutting. I just saw a study on the Tyrannosaurus rex teeth, whether they would rip or cut. And the scientist who got a $20,000 grant to study this momentous piece of information, right, was studying the serrations on T-Rex teeth, right? And of course he came out with the conclusion that T-Rex was in fact a carnivore, not a scavenger. Fascinating. Anyways, now you know. But again, in the article I was looking at it, and one of the things he was talking about was that a nick on a, he was talking about the distinction between the cutting of a serrated blade, which is through tearing, and the cutting of a sharp blade without serrations, which is through a pressure that separates the molecules. I was thinking the Gemara in Chulin says exactly that idea without a $20,000 research grant. But again, the way of doing it is very, and also the animal's flipped. Why is the animal flipped on its back? There are two reasons. One is so the neck is open to shchita, but there's another reason. I spoke to Dr. Elizabeth Kaufman, who is the chief veterinary surgeon at the Biblical Zoo in Jerusalem, and she is one of the top most qualified veterinary surgeons in Israel. She has done surgery on everything from tarantulas to primates, right? And she told me that generally, when they do treatments on animals, they usually flip them or turn them upside down. Why? Because it puts them in a state of temporary stuns them and puts them in a slight state of shock, which means they don't feel the pain of the procedure as much because they're in a state of slight stunning or shock. So just flipping them does that, and consequently, it's not on the contrary, it's to reduce the pain to the animal that they are flipped for that reason. So again, Shchita also, but Nachmanides says, is also to teach us that I'm not dealing with a robot, with an automaton, it is something with feelings, it is something with pain, it is something that feels that pain. Now, we also find, however, that there are restrictions, meaning that yes, we're allowed to use the animals, but as I said, our rights to use the animals are not considered to be 100%. For example, if you have a look in Genesis number 7, source number 7, I quote there from Genesis that it says that Adam was told, you'll rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and over all living creatures. And God said to Adam, I've given you all vegetation and seeds upon the earth, and all fruit-bearing trees to you as food. He says, all living things will be available to you as food. To Noah, God says, all living things will be available to you. To Adam, God just gives the vegetation. To Noah, he gives all living things. Why is there a change? As the Talmud says, Adam was forbidden to eat meat. Noah was permitted to eat meat. Tosfot just comments, doesn't mean Adam was not allowed to kill an animal to get meat, but he was allowed to eat a dead animal. There's obviously not a prohibition against that. Even if you're a vegetarian, there shouldn't be any reason not to do that, right, if the animal's already dead. But again, so Tosfot says he really could eat meat. But again, what's the idea? Why is there a difference? Why is it that Adam could not eat meat and Noah could? Why was Noah given dominion? So there are various explanations given here. Some say it represents an ideal. Perhaps as an ideal, humanity could be vegetarians. But the reality is that it may be that people need meat, it may be that people desire meat, and God does not want to block off from us, right, and doesn't want us to go cold turkey, excuse the expression, right, but rather, right, he says eat it and use it, but do it wisely and do it in measure. So with Noah, there was a lowering in level of humanity, and it was required, so to speak, as a compensation, or that God would give us, the ability to fulfill that desire to have meat, then he allowed us to do so. It's permitted to do so. But what's interesting is, the Talmud quotes, look at sources number 8 and 9. In number 8 it says, you will say I'll eat meat when your soul desires to eat meat. You may eat meat as your soul desires, we are told. But the Talmud comments, a person should not eat meat except in specific circumstances. He should eat it when he's hungry. If you're hungry, eat it. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah ruled, there is a proper proportion of one's flocks which might be slaughtered, so that only occasionally would a person use his animals for food, not on a regular basis. Now, although halakhically, you're allowed to eat meat whenever you want, even if you're not hungry, but what we see is there's an ideal, perhaps, of a certain degree of limitation in that. And number 10, the Talmud says, again, not quoted in the Code of Jewish Law, because it's an ideal, it's not practical halakha, which says the following, this is the Torah of the animals and the birds. Whoever engages in Torah may eat meat. Whoever does not engage in Torah may not eat meat. What distinguishes the human from the animal is our ability to emulate God, to grow spiritually, to have free will. If a person is not doing that, if the person is basically the body, that's it. Right? As one of your, one of the leaders of your country, Jesse Ventura, governor of the state of Minnesota, what does he call himself? Jesse the Body Ventura. He does not call himself Jesse the Soul Ventura. Jesse the Mind Ventura. Right? There are reasons for that, obviously, right? But again, because if the person identifies themselves totally on the material level, we are indeed animals. On the material level, we are indeed animals. What distinguishes us from an animal? Only one thing. Right? What distinguishes us from the animal is the soul. The person who ignores his soul, the person who looks at himself as Jesse the Body Ventura, and ignores, oh, has no right to eat meat. In a sense, he's abusing that privilege. He's just another, he is indeed, right? He's acting as another, I would not say this to him, please don't report it to him, but again, he's acting as an animal. But if he would identify himself as Jesse the Body and Soul Ventura, then he'd be allowed to eat meat. Right, so it depends on your outlook, the Talmud says. The Talmud says the person who does not engage in Torah means a person who ignores the spiritual side of life, indeed, who acts in this world as on a completely materialistic level, on a completely chomri, physical level, such a person doesn't really have that right. Because such a person, what is the difference here? What's the difference? Very little. I mean, on the contrary, right, from a physical point of view, in certain ways we are inferior to certain animals. I mean, we are more versatile, true, we can adapt better. We have the opposable thumb, right? Very important, right? But nevertheless, that's not what life's all about. Life is about things higher than that. That's why the Talmud says that. And I would take it one step further. What about a person who does engage in spiritual growth? What about a person who takes the material world and elevates it? The person who uses the energy and the strength they get from the material world and use it for positive things. What about a person like that? Not only is he allowed, but for such a person, it's a good thing. Have a look at number 11, what Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the great Hasidic master, author of the Tanya, said. If a God-fearing individual eats meat or drinks wine in order to fulfill the mitzvah of pleasure on Sabbath and Yom Tov, that flesh has been affected by a measure of radiance, goes up to the Almighty One as a sacrifice. What has he done? He has elevated it. The way that Tanya puts it is this. He says, the whole world is waiting. Like the Kalabach song, the whole wide world is waiting to sing the song of Shabbos. So the Tanya says, the whole world is waiting to be elevated. He says, the rocks and the soil have a spark of spirituality that's waiting to be realized. How is the spark of spirituality that sustains the soil? How is it realized? How is it elevated? Grass grows on it. Herbs grow on it. Vegetation grows on it. It's elevated to a higher level. How does the vegetation achieve elevation? An animal eats the vegetation. How does the animal achieve elevation? You have chulent on Shabbos. So it is like a spiritual food chain, right? That the man is at the top of the food chain. But we're only at the top of the food chain if we only have the right to be top of the food chain if we're really elevating it. If we're really using our energy for the right purposes. But if basically I eat the meat to increase the bulk, to become Mordechai, the body becher, which I'm tempted sometimes to think, I don't wear sleeveless t-shirts, so you know it's not. Right, but anyway, but there's an idea that, you know, if that's what I'm doing, then it's inappropriate. Then it's inappropriate. You know, now, let's look at some practical halacha. We have got some practical stuff until now. We know that, for instance, I'm allowed to wear leather, but I should not say, wear it out and say a blessing on it. I shouldn't rejoice in that. We know that if I am hungry, if I am a hunter, I need the animal to eat, I'm allowed to hunt. Although to hunt an animal and have it still be kosher is virtually impossible. Because you see, kosher slaughter requires the animal be stationary, requires that you very carefully cut the net. It's very hard. The Talmud mentions there are two people I know of in history, three people who could do this, who could kill an animal while it was on the run and it could still be a kosher slaughter. One was Esav. One was, anyone else know? Yonah bar Tachlifa. And the other was Miyamoto Musashi, I mentioned beforehand, right? Three people. Esav, it says, was able to sharpen an arrow, a long blade on his arrow, and while a bird was in flight or an animal moving, he could shoot it so it would slice a throat. Kosher shchita. Rabbi Yonah bar Tachlifa, one of the sages of the Talmud, was able to do it with a flying bird. No, there are other birds which are kosher as well. Doves, pigeons, swans. I'm sorry? Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah, they have to be shechted. Right? So, I mean, they're not that common, but ducks, geese, swans, right? Turkeys, right? I mean, you know, they're permitted. So, but he was able to do that. And the other is that according to the history of martial arts in Japan, they say that Miyamoto Musashi was able to do the same thing. Okay, which most people believe about him, but they don't believe about some rabbi in the Talmud, right? Which I understand. I mean, rabbis are not usually, you know, the famous archers. But in any case, right, it's virtually impossible to ensure that animal will be kosher by hunting, because we have another issue as well, which is called trefot. Trefot means any one of 70 different types of diseases, injuries, or malformities in an animal render the animal unfit to eat. Which means if you pierce an inner organ of the animal's not kosher. If the animal has a bad break, which a bone is exposed, it's not kosher. If it has deformity of the lung, it's not kosher. So there are a whole bunch of issues which makes hunting virtually impossible. But nevertheless, we're saying it's permitted if you need it. But certainly as recreation, nobody would say it's prohibited. What about using animals for other reasons? Medical experimentation, which there was a major debate I saw recently in Scientific American about it in the past year or two. There was a debate... of research scientists about whether animals were needed for research. Medical research, does it really need animals?
Because it's not only needed for
does the research that's done on animals apply to human beings and really help?
Well, clearly, yeah, that's part of the question. Right, clearly. If a scientist would say that it's needed, that's only needed because it does have an impact, right? So we know... Well, no, you see, it's not quite as simple as that. For example, insulin, that diabetics need insulin, and it's life-giving for a diabetic. Where does that come from? Okay, where has it come from for the past 50 years? Correct. Right, so there is relevance. We also know that the digestive system of a pig is very, very similar to that of a human being, and in fact, there are even moves afoot to actually transplant organs from pigs to human beings because of the similarities in the anatomy. Because, by the way, the Talmud says if stomach disease hits the pigs in the city, you should run away from the city. Because apparently it was observed by the rabbis that there was enough similarity to know that certain diseases would strike in common. Which means there is clearly... It seemed to me, from Scientific American, that the consensus was on the side of animal research. That it was needed, that it was necessary, that it was relevant, and that it obviously has many of our medicines, many of our medical techniques, and surgical techniques have been tested on animals, and indeed we have got tremendous benefit from it. Where do we see this in the Talmud? For example, number 12. Rav Chiya had a pile of flax which became infested with worms. I'm not exactly sure how this works, but okay, flax is what you make linen out of. He came before Rabbi Yehuda the prince to ask his advice, and he said, take a bird, slaughter it over a tub of water, the worms will smell the blood and leave the flax. Now, why was he allowed to kill the bird? What was the benefit to him? Right. Economic benefit. So he was allowed to kill the birds for economic benefit. Now, is killing a bird sar bale chaim, pain to the animal? Depends how you kill it. But death in and of itself is not painful to the animal. I mean, once the animal's dead, it's certainly not painful, right? If the method of slaughter of the animal is indeed done appropriate manner, which is that it's the most painless method possible, then there's no involvement of tzar bale chaim. What if there is pain? So, for instance, the Talmud says, whatever God made in this world was not made for naught. He made a snail which is helpful for curing a scab. He made a fly as an antidote for a hornet's sting. Now, I don't know if these cures are effective, I don't know the exact species they were referring to, but we do know that a tremendous amount of, for instance, I just read recently that scorpions, the venom in scorpions, has been found to be useful in detecting cancer. Okay, now, it's a strange thing, you know, it's like scorpions. You wonder what scorpions are for. My kids brought a scorpion home from a hike a few months ago, right, and, you know... apparently, because I mentioned this thing about scorpion stings being useful for that, so they said, here's a scorpion! I said, oh my God, get the... You know, they said, but you said it was... You have to understand, right? There is this idea, though, and the Talmud believes that, yes, these things are, you know, for us. What about medical reasons, number 14? Whatever is needed for healing, code of Jewish law, whatever is needed for healing or some other purpose is not prohibited because of pain to animals. Therefore, it's permitted to pluck feathers from living geese, which was apparently some type of cure they used to use. Let's leave aside for the moment whether the cure is effective or not. It's just the principle of the matter. The principle is, even though it was painful for the animal, if it would cure a human being, it would be permitted. Nevertheless, Ramos says, you should refrain from doing so since it's cruel. Implication is, if you can do it in a way where there's no cruelty to the animal, if you can find an alternative, should you seek an alternative? Clearly. But if there's no alternative, or if the best medical science says the alternative is not as good as this, is it permitted? The answer is yes. Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, 15, he says, animal experimentation is forbidden if the benefit to scientific knowledge is negligible or trivial, or if an alternative method of acquiring the information is available. It is, however, he says, permissible to cause pain to animals through tests and scientific research or medical study, but as a measure of piety to save oneself from the trait of cruelty, it is certainly correct to refrain from doing so in accordance with the ruling of the Rama. And it seems... Yes?
I have a question about two things. One, when it comes to getting benefit when there's cruelty done to the animal. Like, for instance, why are you allowed to wear a fur coat from an animal that got beaten? Or should you not buy cosmetics from an animal that, you know, was experimenting upon animals just to make sure that you get a little bit better face cream or an eye cream? Are we...
because it seems like we're allowed to get, even though by our buying these products, we are creating a situation where they're clubbing more seals, but yet it seems like we're still allowed to do that.
Well, yes. Now, technically, there's no prohibition, because it is permitted to use the animal for our sake, even if it means there is suffering. However, right, it is certainly an act of piety, right, as we look, if you look at what Yaakov Bryce says, right, for instance, in number 15, if it's only negligible benefit. And according to the Ramah, one of the authors of the Code of Jewish Law, he says it's ideally one should refrain. I once asked my Rebbe, Ramoshe Shapiro, I described to him milk-fed veal. Thank God there's not a lot of kosher milk-fed veal around, right? Veal just generally means a young calf, a calf, right? But milk-fed veal, specific type of veal, in which they confine the animal from birth to a chamber which it cannot move, right? They regularly draw blood from it to keep the flesh anemic. It's just horrific in its cruelty. I asked Rav Moshe Shapiro, what is the law about that? He said it's prohibited to eat such meat. Prohibited. He says such terrible cruelty is prohibited. And then he asked me, he says, how can the American government permit such a thing? He answered the question. He says, oh, of course, there's lots of profit, and hence there are lobby groups, and hence in the democracy, it's okay, right? But again, there is an idea that here was an example of some excessive cruelty. There was no real benefit to the human being, right? You can get on fine without milk-fed veal, I'm sure, right? And he said, indeed, such a thing, because of the incredible cruelty involved, he felt that it was prohibited.
I
can't impose such a rule on everyone. I'll give you why. Because maybe a person's economic situation is such they can't afford the alternative, and maybe they have to buy this. Well, that's why, and for them, for that person, it is a significant benefit. So therefore, I wouldn't give a blanket prohibition, but I think it's certainly an act of piety and appropriate, as the Rama says, to try to refrain from those type of excessive cruelties. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, however, points out that he says, even though there is all this discussion about it, everyone agrees that human life is certainly far and above the animal. How can one possibly give priority to the pain of an animal over the pain of a sick human being if one is capable of helping them? Right? And I'm always reminded, the only group in Germany to protest the transport of Jews to the concentration camps. You know which group protested against it? I wonder. Right, it was the Association for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Why did they protest? So they said if Jews are taken away without any warning, they cannot provide food for their animals who are left behind and suffering. The fact that human beings were being taken away and slaughtered and killed did not bother the ASPCA or the SPCA in Germany. What bothered them was their animals were left behind without food. And in fact, we know that many of the SS guards were very kind to their dogs and their animals. Right? And, you know, it doesn't mean anything to them. We believe that human beings ultimately have to be looked at as the purpose and the goal. And certainly the pain of an animal compared to the pain of a human being cannot be compared. And consequently it is, as Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg says, certainly permitted, right, in the case of necessity, like healing, or something of that need, it is certainly permitted for a human being to use the animal. With that, we'll end.